trying to project an expression of mingled confusion and curiosity. "Who's told other people we've got a stolen computer?" asked Simon.
"I haven't," said Andrew.
Paul stared at his father blankly, trying to process the question. Andrew willed his brother to speak. Why did he have to be so slow?
"Well?"
Simon snarled at Paul.
"I don't think I..."
"You don't think? You don't think you told anyone?"
"No, I don't think I told any..."
"Oh, this is interesting," said Simon, pacing up and down in front of Paul. "This is interesting." With a slap, he sent Paul's exercise book flying out of his hands.
"Try and think, dipshit," he growled. "Try and fucking think. Did you tell anyone we've got a stolen computer?"
"Not stolen," said Paul. "I never told anyone. I don't think I told anyone we had a new one, even."
"I see," said Simon. "So the news got out by magic then, did it?"
He was pointing at the computer monitor.
"Someone's fucking talked," he yelled, "because it's on the fucking internet. I'll be fucking lucky not to lose my job."
On each of the five last words, he thumped Paul on the back of the head with his fist. Paul cowered and ducked. Black liquid trickled from his left nostril. He suffered nosebleeds several times a week.
"And what about you?"
Simon roared at his wife, who was still frozen beside the computer, her eyes wide behind her glasses, her hands clamped like a yashmak over her mouth.
"Have you been fucking gossiping?"
Ruth ungagged herself.
"No, Si," she whispered. "I mean, the only person I told we had a new computer was Shirley, and she'd never..."
"You stupid woman, you stupid fucking woman, what did you have to tell him that for?"
"You did what?" asked Simon quietly.
"I told Shirley," whimpered Ruth. "I didn't say it was stolen, though, Si. I only said you were bringing it home."
"Well, that's fucking it then, isn't it?"
roared Simon. His voice became a scream.
"Her fucking son's standing for election. Of course she wants to get the fucking goods on me."
"But she's the one who told me, Si. Just now, she wouldn't have..."
He ran at her and hit her in the face, exactly as he had wanted to when he had first seen her silly, frightened expression. Her glasses spun into the air and smashed against the bookcase. He hit her again, and she crashed down onto the computer table she had bought so proudly with her first month's wages from Southwest General. Andrew had made himself a promise. He seemed to move in slow motion, and everything was cold and clammy and slightly unreal.
"Don't hit her,"
he said, forcing himself between his parents.
"Don't—"
His lip split against his front tooth, Simon's knuckle behind it, and he fell backwards on top of his mother, who was draped over the keyboard. Simon threw another punch, which hit Andrew's arms as he protected his face. Andrew was trying to get off his slumped, struggling mother, and Simon was in a frenzy, pummeling both of them wherever he could reach.
"Don't you fucking dare tell me what to do. Don't you dare, you cowardly little shit, you spotty streak of piss."
Andrew dropped to his knees to get out of the way, and Simon kicked him in the ribs. Andrew heard Paul say, pathetically, "Stop it." Simon's foot swung for Andrew's ribcage again, but Andrew dodged it. Simon's toes collided with the brick fireplace and he was suddenly, absurdly, howling in pain. Andrew scrambled out of the way. Simon was gripping the end of his foot, hopping on the spot and swearing in a high-pitched voice. Ruth had collapsed into the swivel chair, sobbing into her hands. Andrew got to his feet. He could taste his own blood.
"Anyone could have talked about that computer,"
he panted, braced for further violence. He felt braver now that it had begun, now that the fight was really on. It was waiting that told on your nerves, watching Simon's jaw begin to jut and hearing the urge for violence building in his voice.
"You told us a security guard got beaten up. Anyone could have talked. It's not us."
"Don't you, fucking little shit. I've broken my fucking toe!"
Simon gasped, falling backwards into an armchair, still nursing his foot. He seemed to expect sympathy. Andrew imagined picking up a gun and shooting Simon in the face, watching his features blast apart, his brains spattering the room.
"And Pauline's got her fucking period again,"
Simon yelled at Paul, who was trying to contain the blood dripping through his fingers from his nose.
Get off the carpet! Get off the fucking carpet, you little pansy!
Paul scuttled out of the room. Andrew pressed the hem of his T-shirt to his stinging mouth.
What about all the cash-in-hand jobs?
Ruth sobbed, her cheek pink from his punch, tears dripping from her chin. Andrew hated to see her humiliated and pathetic like this, but he half-hated her too for landing herself in it, when any idiot could have seen.
It says about the cash-in-hand jobs. Shirley doesn't know about them. How could she? Someone at the printworks has put that on there. I told you, Si. I told you you shouldn't do those jobs. They've always worried the living daylights out of...
Fuck you, shut up, you whining cow. You didn't mind spending the money,
yelled Simon, his jaw jutting again, and Andrew wanted to roar at his mother to stay silent. She blabbed when any idiot could have told her she should keep quiet, and she kept quiet when she might have done good by speaking out. She never learned. She never saw any of it coming. Nobody spoke for a minute. Ruth dabbed at her eyes with the back of her hand and sniffed intermittently. Simon clutched his toe, his jaw clenched, breathing loudly. Andrew licked the blood from his stinging lip, which he could feel swelling.
"This'll cost me my fucking job," said Simon,
staring wild-eyed around the room as if there might be someone there he'd forgotten to hit.
"They're already talking about fucking redundancies. This'll be it. This'll..."
He slapped the lamp off the end table, but it didn't break, merely rolled on the floor. He picked it up, tugged the lead out of the plug hole, raised it over his head and threw it at Andrew, who dodged.
"Who's fucking talked?"
Simon yelled as the lamp base broke apart on the wall.
"Someone's fucking talked! It's some bastard at the printworks, isn't it?"
Andrew shouted back. His lip was thick and throbbing. It felt like a tangerine segment.
Do you think we don't know how to keep our mouths shut by now?
It was like trying to read a wild animal. He could see the muscles working in his father's jaw, but he could tell that Simon was considering Andrew's words.
"When was that put on there?" he roared at Ruth. "Look at it! What's the date on it?"
Still sobbing, she peered at the screen, needing to approach the tip of her nose within 2 inches of it now that her glasses were broken.
"The 15th,
she whispered.
15th. Sunday, said Simon. Sunday, wasn't it?
Neither Andrew nor Ruth put him right. Andrew could not believe his luck, nor did he believe it would hold.
Sunday, said Simon. So anyone could have... My fucking toe,
he yelled as he pulled himself up and limped exaggeratedly towards Ruth.
Get out of my way!
She hastened out of the chair and watched him read the paragraph through again. He kept snorting like an animal to clear his airways. Andrew thought that he might be able to garrote his father as he sat there, if only there was a wire to hand.
"Someone's got all this from work,"
said Simon, as if he had just reached this conclusion and had not heard his wife or son urging the hypothesis on him. He placed his hands on the keyboard and turned to Andrew.
"How do I get rid of it?"
"What?"
"You do fucking computing. How do I get this off here?"
You can't, said Andrew. You'd need to be the administrator.
Make yourself the administrator then,
said Simon, jumping up and pointing Andrew into the swivel chair.
I can't make myself the administrator, said Andrew.
He was afraid that Simon was working himself up into a second bout of violence.
You need to input the right username and passwords.
You're a real fucking waste of space, aren't you?
Simon shoved Andrew in the middle of his sternum as he limped past, knocking him back into the mantelpiece.
"Pass me the phone,"
Simon shouted at his wife as he sat back down in the armchair. Ruth took the telephone and carried it the few feet to Simon. He ripped it out of her hands and punched in a number. Andrew and Ruth waited in silence as Simon called first Jim and then Tommy, the men with whom he'd completed the after-hours jobs at the printworks. Simon's fury, his suspicion of his own accomplices, was funneled down the telephone in curt, short sentences full of swear words. Paul had not returned. Perhaps he was still trying to staunch his bleeding nose, but more likely he was too scared. Andrew thought his brother unwise. It was safest to leave only after Simon had given you permission. His calls completed, Simon held out the telephone to Ruth without speaking. She took it and hurried it back into its stand. Simon sat thinking while his fractured toe pulsated, sweating in the heat of the wood burner, awash in impotent fury. The beating to which he had subjected his wife and son was nothing. He did not give them a thought. A terrible thing had just happened to him, and naturally his rage had exploded on those nearest him. That was how life worked. In any case, Ruth, the silly bitch, had admitted to telling Shirley. Simon was building his own chain of evidence as he thought things must have happened. Some fucker, and he suspected that chewing forklift driver whose expression, as Simon had sped away from him in the fields, had been outraged, talking about him to the Mollisons. Somehow, illogically, Ruth's admission that she had mentioned the computer to Shirley made this seem more likely, and they, the Mollisons, the establishment, the smooth and the snide, guarding their access to power, had put up this message on their website. Shirley, the old cow, managed the site, which set the seal on the theory. "It's your fucking friend," Simon told his wet-faced, trembling-lipped wife. "It's your fucking Shirley. She's done this. She's got some dirt on me to get me off her son's case. That's who it is."
"But, Si..." shut up, you silly cow," thought Andrew.
"Still on her side, are you?" roared Simon, making to stand again.
"No,"
squealed Ruth, and he sank back into the chair, glad to keep the weight off his pounding foot. The Harcourt Walsh management would not be happy about those after-hours jobs, Simon thought. He wouldn't put it past the bloody police to come nosing around the computer. A desire for urgent action filled him.
"You," he said, pointing at Andrew, "unplug that computer. All of it. The leads and everything. You're coming with me."
6. Things denied, things untold, things hidden and disguised. The muddy river ore gushed over the wreckage of the stolen computer, thrown from the old stone bridge at midnight. Simon limped to work on his fractured toe and told everyone that he had slipped on the garden path. Ruth pressed ice to her bruises and concealed them inexpertly with an old tube of foundation. Andrew's lip scabbed over like Dane Tully's, and Paul had another nosebleed on the bus and had to go straight to the nurse on arrival at school. Shirley Mollison, who had been shopping in Yarville, did not answer Ruth's repeated telephone calls until late afternoon, by which time Ruth's sons had arrived home from school. Andrew listened to the one-sided conversation from the stairs outside the sitting room. He knew that Ruth was trying to take care of the problem before Simon came home, because Simon was more than capable of seizing the receiver from her and shouting and swearing at her friend.
"Just silly lies," she was saying brightly, "but we'd be very grateful if you could remove it, Shirley."
He scowled, and the cut on his fat lip threatened to burst open again. He hated hearing his mother asking the woman for a favour. In that moment, he was irrationally annoyed that the post had not been taken down already. Then he remembered that he had written it, that he had caused everything. His mother's battered face, his own cut lip, and the atmosphere of dread that pervaded the house at the prospect of Simon's return.
"I do understand you've got a lot of things on," Ruth was saying cravenly, "but you can see how this might do Simon damage if people believe..."
This, Andrew thought, was how Ruth spoke to Simon on the rare occasions when she felt obliged to challenge him, subservient, apologetic, tentative. Why did his mother not demand that the woman take down the post at once? Why was she always so craven? So apologetic. Why did she not leave his father? He had always seen Ruth as separate, good and untainted. As a child, his parents had appeared to him as starkly black and white, the one bad and frightening, the other good and kind. Yet as he had grown older, he kept coming up hard in his mind against Ruth's willing blindness, to her constant apologia for his father, to the unshakable allegiance to her false idol. Andrew heard her put down the receiver, and he continued noisily down the stairs, meeting Ruth as she left the sitting room.
Calling the website, woman?
Yes. Ruth sounded tired. She's going to take those things about Dad off the site, so hopefully that'll be the end of it. Andrew knew his mother to be intelligent and much handier around the house than his ham-fisted father. She was capable of earning her own living.
Why didn't she take the post down straight away if you're friends? He asked, following her into the kitchen.
For the first time in his life, his pity for Ruth was mingled with a feeling of frustration that amounted to anger.
She's been busy, snapped Ruth.
One of her eyes was bloodshot from Simon's punch. Did you tell her she could be in trouble for leaving defamatory stuff on there, if she moderates the boards? We did that stuff in computer.
I told you she's taking it down, Andrew, said Ruth, angrily.
She was not frightened of showing temper to her sons. Was it because they did not hit her, or for some other reason? Andrew knew that her face must ache as badly as his own.
So who do you reckon wrote that stuff about Dad? He asked her recklessly.
She turned a face of fury upon him.
I don't know, she said, but whoever they are, it was a despicable, cowardly thing to do. Everyone's got something they'd like to hide. How would it be if Dad put some of the things he knows about other people on the internet, but he wouldn't do it?
That'd be against his moral code, would it? Said Andrew.
You don't know your father as well as you think you do,
shouted Ruth with tears in her eyes.
Get out! Go and do your homework! I don't care! Just get out!
Andrew returned to his bedroom hungry, because he'd been heading for the kitchen to take some food, and lay for a long while on his bed, wondering whether the post had been a terrible mistake, and also wondering how badly Simon would have to injure anyone in the family before his mother realized that he recognized no moral code whatsoever. Meanwhile, in the study of her bungalow, a mile away from Hilltop House, Shirley Mollison was trying to remember how to delete a post from the message board. Posts were so infrequent that she usually left them there for up to 3 years. At last, she dug out of a filing cabinet in the corner the simple guide to administering the site that she'd made for herself when she started and managed, after several fumbled attempts, to remove the accusations against Simon. She did it only because Ruth, whom she liked, had asked her to. She felt no personal responsibility in the matter. Yet the deletion of the post could not remove it from the consciousness of those who were passionately interested in the forthcoming contest for Barry's seat. Parminder Jawanda had copied the message about Simon Price onto her computer and kept opening it, subjecting each sentence to the scrutiny of a forensic scientist examining fibres on a corpse, searching for traces of Howard Mollison's literary DNA. He would have done all he could to disguise his distinctive phraseology, but she was sure that she recognized his pomposity in Mr. Price is certainly no stranger to keeping down costs and in the benefit of his many useful contacts. Minda, you don't know Simon Price, said Tessa Wall. She and Colin were having supper with the Jawandas in the old vicarage kitchen, and Parminder had started on the subject of the post almost the moment they had crossed the threshold. He's a very unpleasant man, and he could have upset any number of people. I honestly don't think it's Howard Mollison. I can't see him doing anything so obvious.
Don't kid yourself, Tessa, said Parminder. Howard will do anything to make sure Miles is elected. You watch. He'll go for Colin next.
Tessa saw Colin's knuckles whiten on his fork handle and wished that Parminder would think before she spoke. She, of anyone, knew what Colin was like. She prescribed his Prozac. Vikram was sitting at the head of the table in silence. His beautiful face fell naturally into a slightly sardonic smile. Tessa had always been intimidated by the surgeon, as she was by all very good-looking men. Although Parminder was one of Tessa's best friends, she barely knew Vikram, who worked long hours and involved himself much less in Pagford matters than his wife.
I told you about the agenda, didn't I? Parminder rattled on. For the next meeting. He's proposing a motion on the field for us to pass to the Yarville Committee doing a boundary review and a resolution on forcing the drug clinic out of their building. He's trying to rush it all through while Barry's seat's empty.
She kept leaving the table to fetch things, opening more cupboard doors than was necessary, distracted and unfocused. Twice she forgot why she'd got up and sat down again, empty-handed. Vikram watched her everywhere she moved, from beneath his thick eyelashes.
"I rang Howard last night," Parminder said, "and I told him we ought to wait till we're back up to the full complement of councillors before we vote on such big issues. He laughed. He said we can't wait. Yavi wants to hear our views," he said, "with the boundary review coming up. What he's really scared of is that Colin's going to win Barry's seat, because it won't be so easy to foist it all on us then. I've emailed everyone I think will vote with us to see if they can't put pressure on him to delay the votes for one meeting."
"The ghost of Barry Fairbrother," Parminder added, breathlessly. "The bastard. He's not using Barry's death to beat him. Not if I can help it."
Tessa thought she saw Vikram's lips twitch. Old Pagford, led by Howard Mollison, generally forgave Vikram the crimes it could not forget in his wife. Brownness, cleverness and affluence, all of which, to Shirley Mollison's nostrils, had the whiff of a gloat. It was, Tessa thought, grossly unfair. Parminder worked hard at every aspect of her Pagford life. School fetes and sponsored bakes, the local surgery in the parish council, and her reward was implacable dislike from the Pagford old guard. Vikram, who rarely joined or participated in anything, was fawned upon, flattered, and spoken of with proprietary approval.
"Mollison's a megalomaniac," Parminder said,
pushing food nervously around her plate. "A bully and a megalomaniac."
Vikram laid down his knife and fork and sat back in his chair.
"So why," he asked, "is he happy being chair of the parish council? Why hasn't he tried to get on the district council?"
"Because he thinks that Pagford is the epicentre of the universe," snapped Parminder. "You don't understand. He wouldn't swap being chair of Pagford Parish Council for being Prime Minister. Anyway, he doesn't need to be on the council in Yarville. He's already got Aubrey Fawley there, pushing through the big agenda, all revved up for the boundary review. They're working together."
Parminder felt Barry's absence like a ghost at the table. He would have explained it all to Vikram and made him laugh in the process. Barry had been a superb mimic of Howard's speech patterns, of his rolling, waddling walk, of his sudden gastrointestinal interruptions.
"I keep telling her she's letting herself get too stressed," Vikram told Tessa, who was appalled to find herself blushing slightly with his dark eyes upon her. "You know about this stupid complaint, the old woman with emphysema?"
"Yes, Tessa knows, everyone knows. Do we have to discuss it at the dinner table?" snapped Parminder,
and she jumped to her feet and began clearing the plates. Tessa tried to help, but Parminder told her crossly to stay where she was. Vikram gave Tessa a small smile of solidarity that made her stomach flutter. She could not help remembering, as Parminder clattered around the table, that Vikram and Parminder had had an arranged marriage.
"It's only an introduction through the family," Parminder had told her in the early days of their friendship, defensive and annoyed at something she'd seen in Tessa's face. "Nobody makes you marry, you know."
But she had spoken at other times of the immense pressure from her mother to take a husband.
"All Sikh parents want their kids married. It's an obsession," Parminder said bitterly.
Colin saw his plate snatched away without regret. The nausea churning in his stomach was even worse than when he and Tessa had arrived. He might have been encased in a thick glass bubble, so separate did he feel from his three dining companions. It was a sensation with which he was only too familiar, that of walking in a giant sphere of worry, enclosed by it, watching his own terrors roll by, obscuring the outside world. Tessa was no help. She was being deliberately cool and unsympathetic about his campaign for Barry's seat. The whole point of this supper was so that Colin could consult Parminder on the little leaflets he had produced, advertising his candidacy. Tessa was refusing to get involved, blocking discussion of the fear that was slowly engulfing him. She was refusing him an outlet. Trying to emulate her coolness, pretending that he was not, after all, caving under self-imposed pressure, he had not told her about the telephone call from the Yarville and District Gazette that he had received at school that day. The journalist on the end of the line had wanted to talk about Crystal Whedon. Had he touched her? Colin had told the woman that the school could not possibly discuss a pupil and that Crystal must be approached through her parents.
"I've already talked to Crystal," said the voice on the end of the line. "I only wanted to get your..."
But he had put the receiver down, and terror had blotted out everything.
Why did they want to talk about Crystal? Why had they called him? Had he done something? Had he touched her? Had she complained?
The psychologist had taught him not to try and confirm or disprove the content of such thoughts. He was supposed to acknowledge their existence, then carry on as normal. But it was like trying not to scratch the worst itch you've ever known. The public unveiling of Simon Price's dirty secrets on the council website had stunned him. The terror of exposure, which had dominated so much of Colin's life, now wore a face, its features those of an aging cherub with a demonic brain seething beneath a deerstalker on tight grey curls behind bulging inquisitive eyes. He kept remembering Barry's tales of the delicatessen owner's formidable strategic brain and of the intricate web of alliances that bound the 16 members of Pagford Parish Council. Colin had often imagined how he would find out that the game was up. A guarded article in the paper. Faces turned away from him when he entered Mollison and Lowe's. The headmistress calling him into her office for a quiet word. He had visualized his downfall a thousand times, his shame exposed and hung around his neck like a leper's bell, so that no concealment would be possible ever again. He would be sacked. He might end up in prison. "Colin?" Tessa prompted quietly. Vikram was offering him wine. She knew what was going on inside that big, domed forehead. Not the specifics, but the theme of his anxiety had been constant for years. She knew that Colin could not help it. It was the way he was made. Many years before, she had read, and recognized as true, the words of W.B. Yeats, "A pity beyond all telling is hid at the heart of love." She had smiled over the poem and stroked the page, because she had known both that she loved Colin and that compassion formed a huge part of her love. Sometimes, though, her patience wore thin. Sometimes she wanted a little concern and reassurance, too. Colin had erupted into a predictable panic when she had told him that she had received a firm diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, but once she had convinced him that she was not in imminent danger of dying, she had been taken aback by how quickly he had dropped the subject, how completely he re-immersed himself in his election plans. That morning at breakfast, she had tested her blood sugar with the glucometer for the first time, then taken out the pre-filled needle and inserted it into her own belly. It had hurt much more than when deft Parminder did it. Fats had seized his cereal bowl and swung round in his chair away from her, sloshing milk over the table, the sleeve of his school shirt, and onto the kitchen floor. Colin had let out an inchoate shout of annoyance as Fats spat his mouthful of cornflakes back into his bowl and demanded of his mother, "Have you got to do that at the bloody table?"
"Don't be so damn rude and disgusting," shouted Colin. "Sit up properly. Wipe up that mess. How dare you speak to your mother like that? Apologize."
Tessa withdrew the needle too fast. She had made herself bleed. "I'm sorry. You shooting up at breakfast makes me want to puke, Tess," said Fats from under the table, where he was wiping the floor with a bit of kitchen roll.
"Your mother isn't shooting up. She's got a medical condition," shouted Colin. "And don't call her Tess."
"I know you don't like needles, Stu," said Tessa, but her eyes were stinging. She had hurt herself and felt shaken and angry with both of them, feelings that were still with her this evening. Tessa wondered why Parminder did not appreciate Vikram's concern. Colin never noticed when she was stressed. Perhaps, Tessa thought angrily, there's something in this arranged marriage business. My mother certainly wouldn't have chosen Colin for me. Parminder was shoving bowls of cut fruit across the table for pudding. Tessa wondered, a little resentfully, what she would have offered a guest who was not diabetic, and comfort herself with the thought of a bar of chocolate lying at home in the fridge. Parminder who had talked five times as much as anyone else all through supper, had started ranting about her daughter, Sukhvinder. She had already told Tessa on the telephone about the girl's betrayal. She went through it all again at the table. Waitressing with Howard Mollison, I really don't know what she's thinking, but Vikram... They don't think, Minda, Colin proclaimed, breaking his own silence. That's teenagers. They don't care. They're all the same. Colin, what rubbish, snapped Tessa. They aren't all the same at all. We'd be delighted if Stu went and got himself a Saturday job. Not that there's the remotest chance of that. But Vikram doesn't mind, Parminda pressed on, ignoring the interruption. He can't see anything wrong with it, can you? Vikram answered easily. It's work experience. She probably won't make university. There's no shame in it. It's not for everyone. I can see Jolly married early, quite happy.
Waitressing.
Well, they can't all be academic, can they?
No, she certainly isn't academic, said Parminda,
who was almost quivering with anger and tension. Her marks are so absolutely atrocious. No aspiration, no ambition. Waitressing.
Let's face it, I'm not going to get into university.
No, you certainly won't, with that attitude.
With Howard Mollison.
Oh, he must have absolutely loved it. My daughter going cap in hand for a job.
What was she thinking? What was she thinking?
You wouldn't like it if Stu took a job with someone like Mollison, Colin told Tessa. I wouldn't care, said Tessa. I'd be thrilled he was showing any kind of work ethic. As far as I can tell, all he seems to care about is computer games and... But Colin did not know that Stuart smoked. She broke off, and Colin said, Actually, this would be exactly the kind of thing Stuart would do, insinuate himself with somebody he knew we didn't like, to get at us. He'd love that.
For goodness sake, Colin, Sukhvinder isn't trying to get at Minda, said Tessa.
So you think I'm being unreasonable? Parminda shot at Tessa.
No, no,
said Tessa, appalled at how quickly they'd been sucked into the family row. I'm just saying, there aren't many places for kids to work in Pagford, are there?
And why does she need to work at all?
Said Parminda, raising her hands in a gesture of furious exasperation.
Don't we give her enough money?
Money you earn yourself is always different, you know that, said Tessa. Tessa's chair faced a wall that was covered in photographs of the Jawanda children. She had sat here often and had counted how many appearances each child made. Jaswant, 18. Rajpal, 19, and Sukhvinder, 9. There was only one photograph on the wall celebrating Sukhvinder's individual achievements, the picture of the Winterdown rowing team on the day they had beaten St. Anne's. Barry had given all the parents an enlarged copy of this picture in which Sukhvinder and Crystal Whedon were in the middle of the line of eight, with their arms around each other's shoulders, beaming and jumping up and down so that they were both slightly blurred. Barry, she thought, would have helped Parminda see things the right way. He had been a bridge between mother and daughter, both of whom had adored him. Not for the first time, Tessa wondered how much difference it made that she had not given birth to her son. Did she find it easier to accept him as a separate individual than if he had been made from her flesh and blood? Her glucose-heavy, tainted blood. Fats had recently stopped calling her mum. She had to pretend not to care because it made Colin so angry, but every time Fats said, Tessa, it was like a needle jab to her heart. The four of them finished their cold fruit in silence.
7. Up in the little white house that sat high above the town, Simon Price fretted and brooded. Days passed. The accusatory post had vanished from the message boards, but Simon remained paralysed. To withdraw his candidacy might seem like an admission of guilt. The police had not come knocking about the computer. Simon half regretted throwing it off the old bridge now. On the other hand, he could not decide whether he had imagined a knowing grin from the man behind the till when he handed over his credit card in the garage at the foot of the hill. There was a lot of talk about redundancies at work, and Simon was still afraid of the contents of that post coming to the boss's ears, that they might save themselves redundancy pay by sacking himself, Jim, and Tommy. Andrew watched and waited, losing hope every day.
He had tried to show the world what his father was, and the world, it seemed, had merely shrugged. Andrew had imagined that someone from the printworks or the council would rise up and tell Simon firmly no, that he was not fit to set himself up in competition with other people, that he was unsuitable and substandard, and must not disgrace himself or his family. Yet nothing had happened, except that Simon stopped talking about the council, or making telephone calls in the hope of garnering votes, and the leaflets that he had had printed out of hours at work sat untouched in a box in the porch. Then, without warning or fanfare, came victory. Heading down the dark stairs in search of food on Friday evening, Andrew heard Simon talking stiffly on the telephone in the sitting room and paused to listen.
"Withdraw my candidacy," he was saying. "Yes, well, my personal circumstances have changed. Yes. Yes, yeah, that's right. Okay. Thank you."
Andrew heard Simon replace the receiver.
"Well, that's that," his father said to his mother. "I'm well out of it, if that's the kind of shit they're throwing around."
He heard his mother return some muffled, approving rejoinder, and before Andrew had time to move, Simon had emerged into the hall below, drawn breath into his lungs, and yelled the first syllable of Andrew's name before realizing that his son was right in front of him.
"What are you doing?"
Simon's face was half in shadow, lit only by the light escaping the sitting room.
"I wanted a drink," Andrew lied. His father did not like the boys helping themselves to food. "You start work with Mollison this weekend, don't you?"
"Yeah."
"Right, well, you listen to me. I want anything you can get on that bastard, do you hear me? All the dirt you can get, and on his son, if you hear anything."
"All right," said Andrew.
"And I'll put it up on the fucking website for them," said Simon. And he walked back into the sitting room. Barry Fairbrother's fucking ghost.
As he scavenged an assortment of food that might not be missed, skimming off slices here, handfuls there, a jubilant jingle ran through Andrew's mind.
"I stopped you, you bastard, I stopped you."
He had done exactly what he had set out to do. Simon had no idea who had brought his ambitions to dust. The silly sod was even demanding Andrew's help in getting his revenge, a complete about turn, because when Andrew had first told his parents that he had a job at the delicatessen, Simon had been furious.
"You stupid little tit. What about your fucking allergy?"
"I thought I'd try not eating any of the nuts," said Andrew.
"Don't get smart with me, pizza face. What if you eat one accidentally, like at St. Thomas's? Do you think we want to go through that crap again?"
But Ruth had supported Andrew, telling Simon that Andrew was old enough to take care, to know better. When Simon had left the room, she had tried to tell Andrew that Simon was only worried about him. "The only thing he's worried about is that he'd have to miss bloody match of the day to take me to hospital." Andrew returned to his bedroom, where he sat shoveling food into his mouth with one hand and texting Fats with the other. He thought that it was all over, finished, done with. Andrew had never yet had reason to observe the first tiny bubble of fermenting yeast in which was contained an inevitable alchemical transformation.
8. The move to Pagford had been the worst thing that had ever happened to Gaia Borden. Excepting occasional visits to her father in Reading, London was all that she'd ever known. So incredulous had Gaia been when Kay had first said that she wanted to move to a tiny West Country town, that it had been weeks before she took the threat seriously. She had thought of it as one of Kay's mad ideas, like the two chickens she'd bought for their tiny back garden in Hackney, killed by a fox a week after purchase, or deciding to ruin half their saucepans and permanently scar her own hand by making marmalade when she hardly ever cooked. Wrenched from friends that she had had since primary school, from the house that she had known since she was 8, from weekends that were increasingly about every kind of urban fun, Gaia had been plunged, over her pleas, threats and protests, into a life she had never dreamed existed. Cobbled streets and no shops open past 6 o'clock, a communal life that seemed to revolve around the church,
and where you could often hear birdsong and nothing else, Gaia felt as though she had fallen through a portal into a land lost in time. She and Kay had clung tightly to each other all Gaia's life, for her father had never lived with them, and Kay's two successive relationships had never been formalized, bickering, condoling, and growing steadily more like flatmates with the passing years. Now, though, Gaia saw nothing but an enemy when she looked across the kitchen table. Her only ambition was to return to London, by any means possible, and to make Kay as unhappy as she could in revenge. She could not decide whether it would punish Kay more to fail all her GCSEs or to pass them and try and get her father to agree to house her while she attended a sixth form college in London. In the meantime, she had to exist in alien territory, where her looks and her accent, once instant passports to the most select social circles, had become foreign currency. Gaia had no desire to become one of the popular students at Winterdown. She thought they were embarrassing with their West Country accents and their pathetic ideas of what constituted entertainment. Her determined pursuit of Sukhvinder Jawanda was, in part, a way of showing the in-crowd that she found them laughable, and partly because she was in a mood to feel kinship with anybody who seemed to have outsider status. The fact that Sukhvinder had agreed to join Gaia as a waitress had moved their friendship to a different level. In their next period of double biology, Gaia unbent as she had never done before, and Sukhvinder glimpsed, at last, part of the mysterious reason why this beautiful, cool newcomer had selected her as a friend. Adjusting the focus on their shared microscope, Gaia muttered, "It's so frigging white here, isn't it?" Sukhvinder heard herself saying, "Yeah," before she'd fully considered the question. Gaia was still talking, but Sukhvinder was only half listening. So frigging white. She supposed that it was. At St. Thomas's, she had been made to get up, the only brown person in the class, and talk about the Sikh religion. She had stood obediently at the front of the class and told the story of the Sikh religion's founder, Guru Nanak, who disappeared into a river and was believed drowned, but re-emerged after 3 days underwater to announce, "There is no Hindu, there is no Muslim." The other children had sniggered at the idea of anyone surviving underwater for 3 days. Sukhvinder had not had the courage to point out that Jesus had died and then come back to life. She had cut the story of Guru Nanak short, desperate to get back to her seat. She had only ever visited a Gurdwara a handful of times in her life. There were none in Pagford, and the one in Yarville was tiny and dominated, according to her parents, by Chamars, a different caste from their own. Sukhvinder did not even know why that mattered, because she knew that Guru Nanak explicitly forbade caste distinctions. It was all very confusing, and she continued to enjoy Easter eggs and decorating the Christmas tree, and found the books that Parminder pressed upon her children, explaining the lives of the gurus and the tenets of Khulsa, extremely difficult to read. Visits to her mother's family in Birmingham, to the streets where nearly everyone was brown, and the shops full of saris and Indian spices, made Sukhvinder feel dislocated and inadequate. Her cousins spoke Punjabi as well as English. They lived a cool city life. Her female cousins were good-looking and trendy. They laughed at her West Country burr and her lack of fashion sense, and Sukhvinder hated being laughed at. Before Fats Wall had begun his regime of daily torture, before their year had been streamed into sets, and she had found herself in daily contact with Dane Tully, she had always liked returning to Pagford. It had felt then like a haven. While they were fiddling with the slides, keeping their heads low to escape Mrs. Knight's attention, Gaia told Sukhvinder more than ever before about her life at Grosvenor Secondary in Hackney. The words had poured out of her in a slightly nervy stream. She described the friends she had left behind. One of them, Harpreet, had the same name as Sukhvinder's oldest cousin. She talked about Sherelle, who was black, and the cleverest girl in their gang, and about Jen, whose brother had been Gaia's first boyfriend. Though passionately interested in all that Gaia was telling her, Sukhvinder's thoughts strayed, imagining a school assembly where your eyes struggled to pick out individual components of a kaleidoscope composed of every shade of skin from porridge right through to mahogany. Here at Winterdown, the blue-black hair of the Asian kids stood out clearly in the sea of mouse and dun. At a place like Gravener, the likes of Fats Wall and Dane Tully might be in a minority themselves. Sukhvinder asked a timid question. "Why did you move?" "Because my mother wanted to be near her twat of a boyfriend," muttered Gaia. "Gavin Hughes, do you know him?" Sukhvinder shook her head. "You've probably heard them shagging," said Gaia. "The whole street hears when they're at it. Just keep your windows open some night." Sukhvinder tried not to look shocked, but the idea of overhearing her parents, her married parents, having sex was quite bad enough. Gaia herself was flushed, not, Sukhvinder thought, with embarrassment, but with anger. "He's going to ditch her. She's so deluded. He can't wait to leave after they've done it." Sukhvinder would never have talked about her mother like this. And nor would the Fairbrother twins, still in theory her best friends. Neve and Siobhan were working together at a microscope not far away. Since their father had died, they seemed to have closed in on themselves, choosing each other's company, drifting away from Sukhvinder. Andrew Price was staring almost constantly at Gaia through a gap in the white faces all around them. Sukhvinder, who had noticed this, thought that Gaia had not, but she was wrong. Gaia was simply not bothered to stare back or preen herself because she was used to boys staring at her. It had been happening since she was 12. Two boys in the lower sixth kept turning up in corridors as she moved between classes, far more often than the law of averages would seem to dictate, and both were better looking than Andrew. However, none of them could compare to the boy to whom Gaia had lost her virginity shortly before moving to Pagford. Gaia could hardly bear that Marco De Luca was still physically alive in the universe, and separated from her by 132 miles of aching, useless space. "He's 18," she told Sukhvinder. "He's half Italian. He plays football really well. He's supposed to be getting a tryout for Arsenal's youth squad." Gaia had had sex with Marco 4 times before leaving Hackney, each time stealing condoms out of Kay's bedside table. She had half wanted Kay to know to what lengths she was driven to brand herself on Marco's memory because she was being forced to leave him. Sukhvinder listened, fascinated, but not admitting to Gaia that she had already seen Marco on her new friend's Facebook page. There was nobody like that in the whole of Winterdown. He looked like Johnny Depp. Gaia slumped against the desk, playing absent-mindedly with the focus on the microscope, and across the room, Andrew Price continued to stare at Gaia whenever he thought Fats would not notice. "Maybe he'll be faithful. Sherelle's having a party on Saturday night. She's invited him. She's sworn she won't let him get up to anything, but shit, I wish." She stared at the desk with her flecked eyes out of focus, and Sukhvinder watched her humbly, marvelling at her good looks, lost in admiration for her life. The idea of having another world where you belonged completely, where you had a footballer boyfriend and a gang of cool, devoted friends, seemed to her, even if you'd been forcibly removed from it all, an awe-inspiring and enviable state of affairs. They walked together to the shops at lunchtime, something Sukhvinder almost never did. She and the Fairbrother twins usually ate in the canteen. As they hung about on the pavement outside the newsagents where they had bought sandwiches, they heard words uttered in a piercing scream.
"Your fucking mum killed my nan!"
All the Winterdown students clustered by the newsagents looked around for the source of the shouting, puzzled, and Sukhvinder imitated them, as confused as everyone else. Then she spotted Crystal Whedon, who was standing on the other side of the road, pointing a stubby finger like a gun. She had 4 other girls with her, all of them strung along the pavement in a line, held back by the traffic.
"Your fucking mum killed my nan! She's gonna get fucking done and so are you!"
Sukhvinder's stomach seemed to melt clean away. People were staring at her. A couple of third-year girls scuttled out of sight. Sukhvinder sensed the bystanders nearby her transforming into a watchful, eager pack. Crystal and her gang were dancing on tiptoes, waiting for a break in the cars. "What's she talking about?" Gaia asked Sukhvinder, whose mouth was so dry that she could not reply. There was no point in running. She would never make it. Leanne Carter was the fastest girl in their year. All that seemed to move in the world were the passing cars, giving her a few final seconds of safety. And then Jaswant appeared, accompanied by several sixth-year boys.
"All right, Jolly," she said. "What's up?"
Jaswant had not heard Crystal. It was mere luck that she had drifted this way with her entourage. Over the road, Crystal and her friends had gone into a huddle.
"Nothing much," said Sukhvinder, dizzy with relief at her temporary reprieve. She could not tell Jaz what was happening in front of the boys. Two of them were nearly 6 feet tall. All were staring at Gaia.
Jaz and her friends moved towards the newsagent's door, and Sukhvinder, with an urgent look at Gaia, followed them. She and Gaia watched through the window as Crystal and her gang moved on, glancing back every few steps.
"What was that about?" Gaia asked.
"Her great-grand was my mum's patient and she died," said Sukhvinder. She wanted to cry so much that the muscles in her throat were painful.
"Silly bitch," said Gaia.
But Sukhvinder's suppressed sobs were born not only from the shaky aftermath of fear. She had liked Crystal very much, and she knew that Crystal had liked her too. All those afternoons on the canal, all those journeys in the minibus, she knew the anatomy of Crystal's back and shoulders better than she knew her own. They returned to school with Jaswant and her friends. The best-looking of the boys struck up a conversation with Gaia. By the time they had turned in at the gates, he was teasing her about her London accent. Sukhvinder could not see Crystal anywhere, but she spotted Fats Wall at a distance, loping along with Andrew Price. She would have known his shape and his walk anywhere, the way something primal inside you helped you recognize a spider moving across a shadowy floor. Wave upon wave of nausea rippled through her as she approached the school building. There would be two of them from now on, Fats and Crystal together. Everyone knew that they were seeing each other, and into Sukhvinder's mind dropped a vividly coloured picture of herself bleeding on the floor, and Crystal and her gang kicking her, and Fats Wall watching, laughing.
"Need the loo," she told Gaia. "Meet you up there."
She dived into the first girl's bathroom they passed, locked herself in her cubicle, and sat down on the closed seat. If she could have died. If she could have disappeared forever. But the solid surface of things refused to dissolve around her, and her body, her hateful hermaphrodite's body, continued, in its stubborn, lumpen way, to live. She heard the bell for the start of afternoon lessons, jumped up and hurried out of the bathroom. Queues were forming along the corridor. She turned her back on all of them and marched out of the building. Other people truanted. Crystal did it, and so did Fats Wall. If she could only get away and stay away this afternoon, she might be able to think of something to protect her before she had to go back in. Or she could walk in front of a car. She imagined it slamming into her body and her bones shattering. How quickly would she die, broken in the road? She still preferred the thought of drowning, of cool, clean water, putting her to sleep forever. Asleep without dreams.
"Sukhvinder! Sukhvinder!"
Her stomach turned over. Tessa Wall was hurrying towards her across the car park. For one mad moment, Sukhvinder considered running, but then the futility of it overwhelmed her, and she stood waiting for Tessa to reach her, hating her, with her stupid plain face and her evil son.
"Sukhvinder, what are you doing? Where are you going?"
She could not even think of a lie. With a hopeless gesture of her shoulders, she surrendered. Tessa had no appointments until 3. She ought to have taken Sukhvinder to the office and reported her attempted flight. Instead, she took Sukhvinder upstairs to the guidance room, with its Nepalese wall hanging and the posters for Childline. Sukhvinder had never been there before. Tessa spoke and left inviting little pauses, then spoke again, and Sukhvinder sat with sweaty palms, her gaze fixed on her shoes. Tessa knew her mother. Tessa would tell Parminder that she had tried to truant, but if she explained why? Would Tessa intercede?
Not with her son, she could not control fats, that was common knowledge, but with Crystal, Crystal came to guidance. How bad would the beating be if she told? But there would be a beating even if she did not tell. Crystal had been ready to set the whole gang on her. Anything happened, Sukhvinder? She nodded. Tessa said encouragingly, Can you tell me what it was? So Sukhvinder told. She was sure she could read in the minute contraction of Tessa's brow as she listened something other than sympathy for herself. Perhaps Tessa was thinking about how Parminda might react to the news that her treatment of Mrs. Catherine Whedon was being screamed about in the street. Sukhvinder had not forgotten to worry about that as she had sat in the bathroom cubicle wishing for death. Or perhaps Tessa's look of unease was reluctance to tackle Crystal Whedon. Doubtless Crystal was her favourite too, as she had been Mr. Fairbrother's. A fierce, stinging sense of injustice burst through Sukhvinder's misery, her fear, and her self-loathing. It swept aside that tangle of worries and terrors that encased her daily. She thought of Crystal and her mates waiting to charge. She thought of Fats whispering poisonous words from behind her in every maths lesson, and of the message she had wiped off her Facebook page the previous evening. Lesbianism. Noun. Sexual orientation of women to women, also called sapphism, a native or inhabitant of Lesbos. I don't know how she knows, said Sukhvinder, with the blood thrumming in her ears. Knows? Asked Tessa, her expression still troubled. That there's been a complaint about Mum and her great-gran. Crystal and her Mum don't talk to the rest of the family. Maybe, said Sukhvinder. Fats told her. Fats? Tessa repeated, uncomprehendingly. You know, because they're seeing each other, said Sukhvinder. Him and Crystal, going out together? So maybe he told her. It gave her some bitter satisfaction to see every vestige of professional calm drain from Tessa's face. 9. Kay Borden never wanted to set foot in Miles and Samantha's house again. She could not forgive them for witnessing Gavin's parade of indifference, nor could she forget Miles's patronizing laughter, his attitude to Bell Chapel, or the sneery way that he and Samantha had spoken about Crystal Whedon. In spite of Gavin's apology and his tepid assurances of affection, Kay could not stop picturing him nose to nose with Mary on the sofa, jumping up to help her with the plates, walking her home in the dark. When Gavin told her a few days later that he had had dinner at Mary's house, she had to fight down an angry response, because he had never eaten more than toast at her house in Hope Street. She might not be allowed to say anything bad about the widow, about whom Gavin spoke as though she were the Holy Mother, but the Mollisons were different. I can't say I like Miles very much. He's not exactly my best mate. If you ask me, it'll be a catastrophe for the drug clinic if he gets elected. I doubt it'll make any difference. Gavin's apathy, his indifference to other people's pain, always infuriated Kay. Isn't there anyone who'll stick up for Bell Chapel? Colin Wall, I suppose, said Gavin. So, at 8 o'clock on Monday evening, Kay walked up the Walls Drive and rang their doorbell. From the front step, she could make out Samantha Mollison's red Ford Fiesta, parked in the drive 3 houses along. The sight added a little extra zest to her desire for a fight. The Walls door was opened by a short, plain, dumpy woman, in a tie-dyed skirt. Hello, said Kay. My name's Kay Borden, and I was wondering whether I could speak to Colin Wall. For a split second, Tessa simply stared at the attractive young woman on the doorstep, whom she had never seen before. The strangest idea flashed across her mind, that Colin was having an affair and that his lover had come to tell her so. Oh, yes, come in. I'm Tessa. Kay wiped her feet conscientiously on the doormat and followed Tessa into a sitting room that was smaller, shabbier, but cozier than the Mollisons. A tall, balding man with a high forehead, was sitting in an armchair with a notebook in his lap and a pen in his hand.
"Colin, this is Kay Borden," said Tessa. "She'd like to speak to you."
Tessa saw Colin's startled and wary expression, and knew at once that the woman was a stranger to him.